This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, my name's Matt Kemper. I'm the Marketing Manager for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. And today, I'm here with board member, Professor Edmund Shanugabark. Edmund is our Editor-in-Chief for the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. And as we approach our 60th celebrations of the journal in 2019, Edmund's going to give us a whistle-stop tour of his relationship with the journal. Edmund, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name's Edmund Shanugabark, and I am the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. I'm also the Professor of Developmental Psychology, Psychiatry and Neuroscience at King's College London.
Edmund, what are your first recollections of the journal?
Right, well, I go back a long way with JCPP. I did my PhD in a totally unrelated area to the area of child mental health and childhood mental disorders. And so I moved to the Institute of Psychiatry in 1985 to work with Professor Eric Taylor. And so I needed educating at that time. And the JCPP was like my go-to place to learn about child psychiatry and child psychology. So I was reading probably papers published between, say, 82 and 87, when I left to take up my first lectureship in Exeter. I actually had a quick look back at those same issues I'd thumbed over in the library at the Institute of Psychiatry as a young researcher. And golly, it's, the journal's obviously transformed in many ways, but you could still see those core aspects of the journal, the focus on, you know, theoretical literacy, on methodological rigour, and so forth. So it was nice to see that kind of constant thread right to the current day. But at the same time, clearly, the whole approach to the science of child psychopathology has developed so much technologically, but also the rigour of the writing, and actually one big thing, the clarity of the titles. The titles, very often in those you couldn't really work out what the paper was about, but we obviously focus on getting the titles right now.
Was there a particular paper that you remember or resonates particularly with you?
No, it's a good question. So I had a long think about this. As the editor-in-chief and previously the editor, specialist editor for ADHD, I've read a lot of papers. If I go back before that time and I look at those early years, because in a way those were my formative years as a scientist in the area, there are a number of brilliant seminal papers published in JCPP around those times. There was the early papers looking at the heritability of hyperactivity, or ADHD, hyperactivity as many of the papers called it in those days, by Jim Stevenson and Robert Goodman, looking at those early twin studies. There were a series of wonderful papers by Joe Sargent's group coming from the Netherlands. I love that in particular because it showed me that you could really apply the experimental method. So I'd done my PhD in experimental psychology, and it really showed me you could apply the experimental method to this area of research. And what they did was they sort of ran a series of experiments in an attempt to exclude or rule out different sorts of deficits in kids who were hyperactive. So looking at sustained attention deficit, looking at the whole area of executive function, inhibitory control, and gradually, bit by bit, kind of working out what were the deficits and what weren't the deficits. So I love that sort of very surgical approach in those papers. There were great papers by Susan Campbell I saw. Her wonderful longitudinal studies. I didn't really know much about longitudinal research then, or nothing at that point, all those years ago. And so that was an education for me. And then, of course, there were the wonderful papers by people like Michael Rutter on the more fundamental conceptual issues around comorbidity, around diagnosis, and so forth. So yeah, it was a treasure trove. So if you have the chance, do go back online and have a look at some of these papers from that period. Really wonderful seminal papers that, you know, provided the foundation for our whole field.
It must have been a great honour for you to be first published in the journal. How did that feel?
Golly, it's a long time ago. So my first paper in JCVP, my first substantive paper, had a research note in 1991. But my first substantive paper was the first paper on delayed version, one of the concepts that I worked on while I was at the Institute of Psychiatry. And our first paper, The Impact of Delayed Version on Choice Behaviour, came out in 1992. And, of course, you don't know whether it's going to influence the field or have an impact, but just that incredible feeling of actually having published a paper and that people are going to read it. And I published in a journal that was so highly regarded. In hindsight, I understand actually the significance more than I did at the time, perhaps. Although, yeah, it felt, of course, wonderful. I think probably one or two glasses were raised that evening.
JCPP has standards that are second to none in terms of quality. How, as the editor-in-chief, do you maintain these standards?
My golly, yeah, no, we've worked so hard to create, I guess, what you could call a virtuous cycle. Fundamentally, the quality of a journal and its impact depends on the editorial decision making. And so putting the right editors in place is absolutely key. And I feel that that's actually my most important role, is looking across the field, say autism, Eric Fonbon is now our current autism editor, previously it was Sally Ozanoff, two absolutely stellar researchers, identifying the perfect person, bringing that then to the ACAM board, to the board of editors, and get their sort of approval, then writing a persuasive set of emails, having a persuasive set of phone calls, because of course we realise what an enormous undertaking it is to be an editor of JCPP, and my hit rate's not bad. I mean, I think not far off 100%. The people we target, we normally get. And we're very careful about who we target, because not only are they the people making the decisions, they're the people who we trust to make those decisions, completely honest, transparent people, very good judgment, and hard workers. You know, they've got to be hard workers for the field, for the journal. And we'll treat the authors well in terms of the quality of the feedback. And the key issue is the speed of the feedback. We've worked on that so hard to bring down those decision times, to encourage people to submit their best papers to us, to know that they're going to get a good reception from the editors. Even if we don't publish them, they'll have the benefit of a really thorough and transparent review process. And we'll give them good feedback that they can use to improve the paper. So I would say that's the key sort of thing that we've really got to take. Lots of other stuff, of course. But once you get that virtuous cycle going, whereby you improve your processes, you get the right editors in place, people are then encouraged to submit the best papers. Then, of course, you publish better papers, your impact factor goes up. Everybody says they don't care about impact factors. For us, it's really just a consequence that it's a sign that we're doing the right things. We're not aiming for a particular impact, but we're doing the right things. We must be doing the right things. People are using our papers. That's really important. But of course, it's very important to authors. So authors then will see the impact factor, then they'll say, oh, JCPP, we'll submit. So keeping that virtuous cycle going is a really crucial role of the editor-in-chief, I think.
2019 sees the celebration of the 60th year of the journal. But what is the future for the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry?
We've changed so much. I mean, I've been editor-in-chief since about 7 years now. And I think even in that time, we've changed really an awful lot with a broadening of our editorial base. So now we have roughly, I think it's around 16 or 17 editors who are actually actively processing and deciding on papers. And the idea behind that, and again, that's been really important for us, I think, is that we have specialist editors so that the authors can feel confident that they're going to their paper's going to be processed and read by an editor who understands what they're trying to do, understand the significance of it and the value of it. And also those editors are close to their field so they can encourage people to submit the best papers. So that's been really important, and you know, maybe we'll broaden even further the specialist base of editors. There are some areas where we don't currently have a specialist editor. So for instance, callous and emotional traits or conduct disorder, we don't have a specialist editor. Maybe that's where we'll, one of the areas we'll move to in the future. I mean, in terms of the quality of what we do, I think we are at a optimal balance between speed and accuracy, using a cognitive concept I don't think we can go any quicker in terms of our decision making and still make really good decisions without actually killing off all our editors under the pressure, and we definitely don't want to do that. So I would say at that level we are about optimal. In terms of the improvements bedding in and encouraging more improved submissions from a broader range of constituencies, I think we can do more on that probably. The big challenge we're going to face, or the big area that we realise we need to address, is this whole issue of scientific reproducibility. It's described as a crisis within science, and I think it does have some of the hallmarks of a crisis. Much of the empirical research that's published isn't reproducible, and therefore probably not true, reflecting reality. Now, there are loads of reasons for that. And as a journal, we've made a big commitment to transparency to try and improve that. We have agreed a policy whereby we're going to encourage the pre-registration of studies, not just trials, but all studies. We have decided that pre-registration isn't something that we want to do as a journal. That was a very big and lively and interesting discussion we had amongst the editors. So we have decided that we're not going to be a platform for pre-registration. It's not something that we want to focus on. And in fact, we think we probably ought to be a little bit independent of that process in terms of decision making. But we'll certainly be encouraging our editors, our authors rather, to pre-register their papers. We already expect that of trials, of course, but other studies too. And we will acknowledge that pre-registration in the papers to encourage that. Whether we go further along that route, that's to decide. And we're a very democratic group. I mean, I'm the editor-in-chief. Obviously, I coordinate these discussions, but really all of our decisions are a group-based decisions with all of our editors chipping in. So it's very much a communal approach to the journal moving forward.
Thanks very much for your time, Edmund. Before you go, I'm sure people would like to know what you're currently working on.
Lots of different things. Obviously, the ADHD is still a big focus of my work. And having just moved to King's College London, it's a couple of years now. Time's starting to fly. It's a couple of years now. We've set up a new lab, and we have started a new it was a wonderful blank page for me, and started a new set of really interesting and inspiring studies, particularly looking at the practical impact of so-called default mode dysregulation in ADHD. First of all, in terms of preschool children developing the competence to shift from resting to or recreational to active states, which seems like a pretty key skill for children to acquire before they go into formal education, on the one hand. And the second area, also linked to the default mode, is the whole issue of future orientated oriented decisions in adolescence. And we know that the default mode is involved in introspective and prospective type cognition. So we're really going to be exploring that. The other area that I'm very focused on is the English and Romanian adoptee study, a brilliant study that much of it published in JCPP in the past. the study founded by Sir Michael Rutter, and he entrusted that study to me. I'm now the PI, and we're in the young adult phase, and we are currently just locked the data on a brain imaging study, and so we're in the process of analysing the data, looking at the impact of early deprivation on brain structure and function in those young people who suffered in the institutions in Romania all those years ago. So that's inspiring me and challenging me as well in terms of trying to understand exactly what are the impacts and what's the implications for both neuroscience but also for mental health studies.
Thank you for your time, Edmund. You can find more about the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry by following us on Twitter at @JCPP, and you can also visit us online at www.acamh.org. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.